You may have heard this already. Wealth is not evenly distributed in America. Some people have so much money they can't possibly spend it all. Some people have so little money they are a medical issue or a broken car away from financial disaster. Our guest this hour wants to focus on the people who do not have a cushion of money in the bank. Robert E. Friedman's book is appropriately titled. It's called A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. Robert E. Friedman founded an economic development nonprofit nearly 40 years ago and called it the Center for Enterprise Development. It is now called Prosperity Now, and he's the chair emeritus of it and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Your opening story about riding the bus into Atlanta fascinated me. Can you share that with us?
Sure. I went to Atlanta to find myself found myself on a bus from Decatur, a near suburb, into the center city at kind of mid-afternoon, and it was me and 30 to 40 African-American maids, really, in their 30s, 40s, 50s. And as luck would have it, I had to go to the bank. Three of the women got off. I followed them to the bank, and they lined up behind each other, and I lined up behind them. And I watched as each pulled out a crumpled envelope with change and a few dollar bills and presented it to the teller. So when I got up to the front, I said, "So what was that?" And they said, "Oh, it's our Christmas club. We're helping them save to buy presents for their kids at Christmas." And I said, "Oh, that sounds cool. What interest rate do you pay?" And they said, "Oh, no. You don't understand. This is a service we provide. We don't pay interest." And I was outraged. Why would my dollar worth more than their dollar? Why should this financial system not serve low-income people just as well as it serves upper-income people?
So you're saying at that same bank, if you had walked in and opened a savings account, there would have been interest paid on it?
Yes. Yes.
Well, you are a believer, it would appear from your book, in markets and capitalism, but with some limits. And what kinds of limits do you see?
Well, I think capitalism works pretty well if you have capital. I think if you don't have capital, as really most Americans and, you know, great majorities of people of color don't, then it doesn't work so well. So really, I think one way you could see what I'm suggesting is I'm just talking about a fix to capitalism so that we can all play. And my privilege over the last 40 years has been to watch low-income, even very poor people start businesses, buy homes, go to college, create economic futures for themselves and their families. I think we're leaving, in Van Jones's word, genius on the table. We need to open the doors of the economy again to let people play, and I think we will all do better if we do that.
Robert, you report that the people on both the left and the right view you with some suspicion. Why is that?
Well, it can operate both ways. I kind of feel like, you know, on a bad day, I can rappel across the political spectrum. On a good day, I can attract across it. Again, what I'm arguing is, based on experience, that people want to do the right thing. People want to support their families. People want to work. And people have ingenious ideas about the ways forward for them. What they need is a chance. And so I'm not talking giving people something for nothing. I'm basically talking about doing for everyone what today we only do for the wealthy. We, each year at the federal level and also at the state level, incentivize, or if you will, subsidize people to buy houses, go to college, start businesses, save, and invest. But the way we do it, we basically reward the rich, miss the middle, and penalize the poor. I just think if we're going to spend $700+ billion a year, we ought to enable everybody to play. So I think it's a democratic idea. It's based on enterprise, on savings, on match. I will often endorse liberal match proportions so that if you save a dollar, you might get $2 or $3 put into that savings account for business, for education, for home. But, you know, you have to earn that. So I think, and I have high expectations of low-income people based on experience. So I think that, across the political spectrum, we have underestimated the capacity of low-income people. Again, as not just as beneficiaries, trainees, employees, but as entrepreneurs, homeowners, creators of wealth. So in that way, I think I diverge from right and left. The traditional way we've combated poverty in the 20th century was to create a safety net and social services, which help people eat and be housed, but it doesn't really provide an out. And in fact, it contains within it penalties if you do any of the things you need to do to move forward, learn, earn, save, invest. So we remove benefits entirely from people who are managed to save more than a few thousand dollars for college.
Let's talk about how when we come back. I really want to get a little further into how you feel like we penalize the poor in America and reward the rich. We'll come back and talk more with Robert E. Friedman. He's the author of A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. Join the conversation by phone or email. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Robert E. Friedman, who founded an economic development nonprofit nearly 40 years ago, the Center for Enterprise Development. It is now called Prosperity Now. He's the chair emeritus of it and the author of a spanking new book about how we can do things better for people in this country to make sure that equality economically is spread evenly. His book is called A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let me come back to what you were just saying, that in our country, through our policies, we reward the rich, we skip the middle, and we penalize the poor. Is that just through tax policy or some other things?
Oh, it's both tax and spending policy. We have a thoroughgoing set of tax incentives, both federal and state, that are directed at helping families build wealth. Home mortgage interest deduction, preferential capital gains rate, pension fund exclusions, 529 college savings plans. But we design them in such a way using tax deductions that really the benefit goes to the very wealthiest. So if you pool all of those just at the federal level, they exceed $700 billion a year. That's with a B. That rivals the Defense Department in size of expenditure.
It does. Mm-hmm.
But the top, the wealthiest 0.1%, this is people or families making over $1 million a year in income, get an average annual benefit from those incentives or subsidies, averaging $160,000 a year, while working families making $55,000 or less get $226 on average. That is $1 for every $800 the wealthiest do. The private sector in this country is doing fine at generating wealth inequality, which dwarfs income inequality, I think, both in size and in dynamics. I think, you know, we have no need to subsidize wealth inequality, and it's obscene and counterproductive in this environment to do that.
So I want to understand the difference between wealth inequality and income inequality. Wealth being what you have versus income being what you're bringing in.
That's right. So income would be current revenues, mostly for most people, wages, but also dividends and interest if you're among the relatively small percentage of people who own stock. And wealth is what you have. It's assets minus liabilities. And it performs in different ways. And Michael Sheridan, who wrote the seminal book, Assets and the Poor, said, income may feed people's stomachs, but assets change their heads. Assets are hope in concrete form. They're a reserve that allows you some safety and some resilience in the face of accidents or illnesses. Again, most Americans, literally like 57% of Americans, would have to resort to borrowing confronted with an unexpected $500 bill. They're living on the edge, and I think if you're living in debt, you're not thinking forward in general. You're under stress, and you're probably not thinking that well of yourself. Having even a small nest egg, a few thousand dollars, as I argue in the book, buffers you from the everyday accidents and illnesses. It allows you to think ahead, you know, what is a way that you can do better in the future, and it gives you the ability to and a reason to plan and prepare for that future when you may only believe, and ultimately the ability to invest in yourself and your kids.
So that brings us really back to the title of the book, A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. Robert Friedman, where does the few thousand dollars come from?
Again, I would take it from, you know, I would simply reapportion the money we're spending in, frankly, stupid and unjust ways and spread it, make it into an investment in the lives and futures of every American. That $700+ billion at the federal level comes down to an average of $2,200 for every man, woman, child in the country. You know, I would ask your listeners, what could you do with an extra few thousand dollars? Again, we being Prosperity Now, the organization I founded, and our partners, including many good partners in Oregon, have demonstrated over 40 years that given the opportunity to have their savings matched with a few thousand dollars a year, low income, even very poor people will start businesses, buy homes, go to college, and expand the economy. That's what I would like to see.
This really comes back to redoing the Christmas Club as you founded in that bank in Atlanta.
Right. I think we've had a lot of institutions, both in our country and in our families. I mean, essentially, we learn from what families have been doing from time immemorial. You want that bike, get a paper route, and we'll contribute half. And by the way, in the process, you're learning about money and work. Now I would just institutionalize it, and we do have systems like this and successful policies in our past. So most of our retirement system is built on matched savings accounts. You sign up for a job with a large employer. On the first day, you're presented with papers. You can choose to have a certain percentage of your paycheck deducted each month and put into a retirement savings account. The employer matches that. The government provides generous tax benefits. And lo and behold, in a few months or a few years, you have a nest egg for your retirement. I would simply set up that kind of system for everybody, and for these wealth-building investments that get you to a secure retirement. We have many examples in our history. I would argue the best policies, economic policies we've had, those that generate long-term, widespread, significant increases in economic well-being, are policies like the Homestead Act, universal public education, the creation of the 30-year mortgage by the federal government, and then the GI Bill. GI Bill, we invested in the businesses, homes, education of returning GIs after World War II. Those GIs built our post-war economy. In a decade, we tripled the middle class. We turned the income distribution from a pyramid to a diamond, generated 220,000 businesses, 5 million homeowners, 9 million new college students, transformed the country. What I really want to see is a GI Bill for the 21st century for everybody, based on matched savings for home, business, education, other high return individual investments, and designed in such a way that we can close the gaping racial wealth divide in our lifetimes.
Robert E. Friedman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the founder of what was then called the Center for Enterprise Development, is now called Prosperity Now. He's the chair emeritus and the author of a book called A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. This is a conversation you're welcome to join on the Jefferson Exchange. You probably have a few ideas about how things could be better financially for a lot of people without much effort. 800-838-3760 to call in for the conversation, or send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. We have a couple people waiting to talk, one of whom, Patricia Ann in Eureka, sent an email. And she writes, the Social Security payroll tax is capped at around $110,000 annual income. In other words, you don't pay it above that. Please speak to this. Thank you. Yours in least waste, Patricia Ann in Eureka.
Your caller is right, and I think we should lift that cap. There's no reason that higher income people shouldn't pay a higher amount, I think, to ensure the retirement security of everybody.
So right now, basically, you're $100,000 is the highest level of income, but which you pay beyond that, you're not paying anymore.
Correct. Yeah. So you're not paying into the system. We can bolster each other. I must say that I want to recognize Oregon. It's been a leader in what we call individual development accounts, which one welfare mother said, oh, I see what you mean. You mean a 401k retirement account except for me.
Uh-huh. Is that what Oregon
saves? The only state, I believe, that has an IDA tax credit. You have funded, Oregonians have funded other Oregonians to save in matched accounts. And as a result, Oregon has hundreds more homeowners, entrepreneurs, businesses, jobs, than it would have had otherwise.
We just talked to
unleashing the productive capacity of Oregonians.
Yeah, the state treasurer was on just a couple of weeks ago talking about the Oregon Saves program, set up to do just what you're talking about, to set some money aside from people's income for places that don't have 401ks or 403bs or whatever.
And I just would argue, I think other states should do as Oregon has done, and that the federal government should come in and put its resources on the side of all Oregonians.
Here's a phone call from Mark in Reading. Thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Friedman.
Good morning. Yes.
Good morning.
There used to be an official Christmas Club account. I don't know if it still exists. It was a business all over the country, and one man owned that business. Therefore, he had control of all that money prior to it having to be paid out for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was able to use that money to make money during that period of time.
Or so he was investing the money, you're saying, and then brought it back to the people and gave them their part back.
And they, nobody ever got any interest. My parents had Christmas Club accounts every year, and they never got any interest. It was never the way it was designed, it was you never got any interest.
Okay.
Thanks. And he also owned the S&H Green Stamp Company. I don't remember his name.
Okay.
You may not know about S&H Green Stamps. It was a thing where you got stamps when you went to buy groceries at certain stores, and you put them in a book, and you got enough books, and you buy stuff.
I remember that. You used to lick the stamps and stick them in the books and then try to redeem them for your stuff, whatever the stuff was. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate that. Does that ring with your knowledge of Christmas Club accounts, Robert?
Yeah, I must admit that I don't know about that example. I do remember green stamps. I believe that it is part the responsibility of the public sector to create a marketplace where everybody can play. This is the idea, the basic idea of this country, right? That we're all created equal, and we should all be able to play and bring our ideas and talents to the marketplace, and we'll all do better if we do. I think, and the government has from time to time redesigned the market so that it works for all Americans. I think one of the great examples is the creation of the 30-year mortgage by the federal government. 120 years ago, only 10% of Americans owned their own homes, and it was pretty simple why. You had to come up with a full price of the house on purchase. Very few Americans could do that. We created the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage backed by Ginnie Mae and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to provide low-interest, long-term loans, self-amortizing loans, and brought home ownership in the purview of the American people. And so now, today, and at two-thirds of Americans, roughly, own their own homes. We've done that in discriminatory ways. Those mortgages were often not afforded to African-Americans and other people of color.
And when you say not afforded, they just weren't offered. We're talking about redlining, like in the greater Detroit.
Exactly.
Area.
Mm-hmm. All over the country. And again, this is a combination of both public law and regulation and practice and private operations. But, it's so today, while 72.5% of whites own their own homes, only 43% of African Americans and 46% of Latinos own their own homes. This is a difference created by policy. It's classic discrimination, and we all do worse for it. Again, what we've demonstrated with individual development account programs, with other demonstrations, is that low-income families can buy and keep homes and benefit from the capital appreciation, wealth creation, if you will, of those homes if we structure the market right. Let's structure the market right.
Well, a couple of questions here from Rebecca in Lane County, who sent in an email, and she asks, how do we ever overcome intergenerational poverty with the attendant behaviors and resistance to education? Will people all have to be in big cities to work and start businesses? Will Amazon squelch many, many small businesses? It's just so complicated, writes Becca.
It's a great question, and I do propose an answer, which has come bottom-up in this country, which is what I call in the book generation accounts, more popularly referred to as child savings accounts, child development accounts. And this would be the idea of both endowing kids with, today is mostly a few hundred dollars, to a few thousand dollars, and also matching the savings of parents for their education. There are now child college savings account programs in 42 states, I think, including Oregon. Oregon was one of the pioneers. In Maine, every kid born in the state gets $500 at birth, and then the state matches the first $250 in savings. We could create child accounts for every kid just by reinstating the estate tax to where it was in the early 2000s and maybe getting rid of the so-called stepped-up basis of capital gains at death, where the very wealthy pay no tax on inheritance. Instead of subsidizing inheritance for the few, let's create an inheritance for every kid. We know now through extensive experiments and rigorous evaluation that it makes a difference. A poor child with a college savings account in her own name is three times more likely to go to college and four times more likely to finish, even with only $500 in the account or less. It's a matter of expectation. If you expect that you're going to go to college, you probably will.
Huh. It's sort of like getting stamped at birth, a person who's going to go to college. And as you pointed out, the dollars aren't so much important as the indication that, yes, this is a person who's going to college. Much more to talk about with Robert Friedman. His book is A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. More phone calls and emails welcome here on The Exchange when we return in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about inequality in America, wealth and income inequality, and the fact that we can do a better job at balancing things out. And Robert Friedman shows how in a book called A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. He is the founder of an economic development nonprofit called the Center for Enterprise Development, or it was called that. It's now called Prosperity Now. He is the chair emeritus of it. Your thoughts, comments, questions, welcome. How do we get more money into the pockets of people on the lower ends of the income scale? And does that provide prosperity for all is the question before us. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. And Robert, I want to make it clear that you didn't get into this line of work and activism because you were a cranky poor person. You actually grew up with money, with the Levi Strauss money in the family, and have some memories about how the company played fair with workers over the years.
Yeah, I must say, I often have to admit, I majored in luck all my life. And, I grew up with money, which was an advantage. An even greater advantage was having the parents and the family that I had. And even the tradition of Levi Strauss and Company that, kept on all of its factory workers during the Depression, refinishing floors if necessary, also as it built plants in the segregated South, would not put a plant in anywhere that it couldn't run an integrated facility. I think it's possible to do good and do well at the same time. I realized that, when it came time to figure out what to do with my life, I wanted others to have the chances that I had had. And again, I think this is a win-win policy that, the idea of America is a great idea, that, everyone deserves a chance, that everyone should be able to bring their dreams and ideas and work to the marketplace to make for a better country. And I do believe we will do better this way.
It gets back to a question that Becca asked among her flock of questions in her email, which is about entrepreneurship. And you're not the only person who talks about the value of entrepreneurship, but is it for everyone? I mean, does everybody have the capability to start a business or come up with an idea that could lead to a business within them, you think?
Of course not. I mean, not everybody is an entrepreneur or wants to be one. That said, all the net new jobs created in our economy over the last 30 years have been created by new businesses. Not existing businesses, large or small, they grow and decline in size and stay at about the same level. But it's new businesses that each year that add an average of about 2 million jobs to the economy. And they, you know, and they come from across the income spectrum. Some of our most famous entrepreneurs, you know, do not come from, you know, the laps of rich living. They start businesses because they have to, and they're ingenious at doing so. So, but it does the financing for new businesses starts with personal savings or savings of friends, family, associates. That's a financing system that actually works brilliantly where you're betting on an individual rather than on a business plan. It doesn't work so well if there's no capital around. And I think the rise in debt for structural reasons over the last 20 years has wiped out the reserves of most American families and cut down on the rate of entrepreneurship. So instead of creating 3 million businesses a year as we were 20 years ago, we're creating about 2 million.
You talk a lot about tax incentives and switching some of the things around that keep the tax benefits from going to the top of the income scale and the wealth scale. But we haven't talked at all really about anti-poverty programs, welfare programs, whatever you want to call them, and your thoughts about how those do or do not work today and what you're talking about, how it fits into that system.
Right. I have a lot of respect for the safety net. It was the great advance against poverty in the 20th century. But then there are, in almost all of those programs, asset limits, benefit reduction provisions. That mean as soon as an individual is doing the things she or he deems necessary to move forward, again, going to school, working, learning, saving, investing, will often become, or she'll become, ineligible for benefits. I think that serves no one well. So what we need, and I think the job of the 21st century, is to build the ladder, to make sure that everybody can take their skills and work ethic to the marketplace. And depending on what their route is, and only they can figure that out, whether it's education or business or homeownership and farming, pursue that.
Let us take a call. We have Skeeter in Eugene on the line. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Friedman, the author of A Few Thousand Dollars.
Hiya. Thanks for a great program. I want to run by another option scenario, the whole realm of parallel currencies. I'm curious your impression of such a concept of, let's say, people run for office in Lane County and they win and they say, okay, now we're going to go ahead and do like we said, we're going to create a parallel currency and maybe even have the gold standard be the average price of a ton of industrial hemp and distribute, kind of like the old game of Monopoly, distribute the money to every citizen, every infant, adult, teenager, let's say give them $5 million. Another option would be instead of just handing it to them directly, say come up with a proposal such as you would give to a bank and then give them money on a no interest basis. When they have a proposal for some sort of entrepreneurial idea. Anyway, I'd like to get your impression of that. Thank
All
you.
Right. Local currencies. Thanks for that, Skeeter.
Yeah. Thank you for that question and for your ideas. I think this whole area is one where ripe for innovation. I think there are different funding sources. I have focused on, again, what we're already spending in the name of promoting family wealth building through business, home, education, savings, and the like. There are other sources. I think what Alaska has done with the Alaska Permanent Fund, saying, look, this oil, if it belongs to anyone, it belongs to everyone. And they took a portion of the revenues, put it in the Alaska Permanent Fund, and every Alaskan now gets a check for $1,000, $2,000 each year out of their common ownership of this essential asset. There are proposals from Peter Barnes and others that we should do a national permanent fund. With, for example, funded by the carbon absorptive capacity of the atmosphere, that wherein we could auction off, set a limit for carbon emissions, which could come down over time, auction off those rights to pollute, essentially, to the 2,000 firms where carbon enters the economy, and return the proceeds on a one-person, one-share basis. I think we would simultaneously create basic income for folks and limit carbon emissions.
All right, here you mentioned basic income, and I was leading up to ask you how what you're talking about here in a few thousand dollars corresponds, dovetails with, or has nothing to do with universal basic income, which a lot of people have been talking about again in recent years.
Right. Thank you for that question. Really, universal basic assets is how I would characterize what I'm proposing, is a form of universal basic income. It's another source of money coming in. I would, again, the average current expenditure on these wealth building tax expenditures is $2,200 for every man, woman, child in the country every year. I would say we should demand our share, our fair share. I think that universal basic assets as compared or contrasted to universal basic income are economically, socially, and politically more practical right now than universal basic income. Economically, we have the money. We know where it's coming from, which is not a case for the $3.9 trillion price tag of a robust universal basic income scheme. We should still look for that money. We also know that these are investments, high return investments in the old-fashioned sense, that a dollar today will become $2 tomorrow. Socially, it's not something for nothing. It's people have to save, people have to work at making their business or their education pay off, and again, it returns to all. So it really respects the productive capacity of people and doesn't treat them just as consumers, which I'm afraid that some of the UBI schemes do. And finally, politically, I think we're much readier to, again, across the political spectrum, to embrace a policy that encourages people to start businesses, buy homes, go to college. The things we know expand the economy over time.
There's also something in the book about the American Dream demonstration. This is something that started under the Clinton administration, and has that continued, or is it still so in some form out there?
Well, it was a time-limited national demonstration we conducted in partnership with community groups around the country, urban and rural, Native American, Latino, all over, and we applied rigorous evaluation techniques to it. It's over. But what it led to, it's over. It generated, measures of effectiveness that we still know to this day, for example, that the poorest fifth of participants, people living at half the poverty line, saved about as much and at three times the rate of higher income people, not because the saving was easy, but because it was the price of stability and the price of hope. There were a lot of other findings from that demonstration. It fueled the growth of individual development account programs around the country, community, local, state, and federal. There was federal policy until last year supporting those programs. It was eliminated not because of the findings of efficacy, but those findings were ignored. We're ready to go to scale on it. Again, Oregon and Oregon's community organizations and neighborhood partnerships have been at the forefront of operating those individual development account programs.
All right, a lot more to come in this area, obviously. The book by Robert Friedman is called A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. Robert, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Sure, take care.